In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
And welcome. Glad you're joining us for today's show, as it is a very special one. It is our annual 4th of July show, our 12th annual show, as every year we focus on the 4th and its special meaning. Previously, we've focused on such things as celebrating the 4th down through history, what those early celebrations looked like, the Declaration of Independence itself, the rights and grievances listed therein, celebrating the 4th on the Oregon Trail, one of my personal favorites, during the Civil War, the first 50 years, major anniversaries, and lots of other topics, and last year's focus on some of the signers of the Declaration and its predecessor petition. But, you know, as we were hashing out ideas for this year's show, it suddenly occurred to me that we have never focused on the one key guy in the Revolution, the guy who won it, George Washington. We've talked incidentally about him, but never directly zeroed in on him, so that's this year's show, July 4th and George Washington. To talk about George Washington and get to know him a little better, I'd like to welcome back our annual guest for these annual shows, Greg Leo. He's a government and public affairs consultant to governments, tribes, corporations, and individuals, and he's our expert on the 4th of July because he's an avid amateur historian. Greg, welcome back to the show. How has it been another year gone already?
Well, thank you, Mark. It's been a great year, and we're looking forward to having a good conversation today about George Washington.
Yeah, this is going to be a really fun show, I think, just a back-and-forth discussion about George, his life, and his career, and what truly made him special. We'll try to be somewhat chronological, but we'll just go where the discussion takes us. But let's start there with his birth. He was actually born the son of a plantation owner. What can you tell us about his early years?
Well, it was hard at first. I think he was born way out in the Virginia countryside, and he didn't have a lot of money in the first part of his life. And he had the struggle. A lot of struggles. Had a difficult mother who was, you know, very hard on him in some ways. He cut loose at about 14 and started surveying out in the wilderness of Virginia, and then got involved with the British Army and fought in the French and Indian Wars, which really became the 12 Years' War. And one of the first shots of that World War was actually fired by George Washington.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in fact, one of the readings that I saw was that he incidentally or accidentally set off really what became a world war at the time, part of that. I did find it interesting that, you know, he was born to that plantation owner, but he was not the oldest son. He was the oldest son of a second wife, so he wasn't going to directly inherit that. Originally, but he did choose surveying profession. So why do you feel that he went that direction with becoming a surveyor?
He had to work his way up, and you know, life was hard and had to be earned. The one thing about George Washington that is just so clear throughout his entire life was that he's a self-made man, and kind of the original ideal of the American self-made man. Mm. So starting from, you know, fairly humble beginnings, working hard as a surveyor, proving himself in battle, he kind of rose through the aristocracy there in Virginia, eventually marrying one of the richest women in Virginia, Martha.
Right. It was an interesting skill that he used throughout his life. He did that for about 10, 15 years, as I recall. But he did use those skills throughout his lifetime as he acquired new properties, defending his property's borders. Washington at one point owned nearly 70,000 acres between the Potomac and Ohio rivers. You had mentioned his early involvement with the French and Indian Wars. But before he got there, I didn't know this, he had gone to Barbados with his older brother because his older brother was had pneumonia at the time and just wasn't feeling well. So they thought, you know, going to the tropics might help clear things up a bit. But while he was there, he contracted smallpox.
And he did.
It's actually very fortunate that he did. It's actually fortunate that he did, because later on during the Revolution, smallpox was a major enemy, so to speak, because it kept ravaging the troops. And had he not gotten smallpox when he was younger, you know, who knows? He may have died during the war from smallpox rather than being shot. So
there's all of these kind of small miraculous yes. things about George Washington that kind of, when put together, you say this guy was extremely lucky and really had providence looking out for him. So having smallpox when he was young in Barbados did inoculate him, so to speak, against smallpox. And of course, smallpox was a major killer of the Continental Army
yes.
Later on in life. But he had resistance because he had it as a young man.
Well, you mentioned the blessings, and I think that's one of the more interesting things about George Washington that I've always admired. You look at things like the smallpox and how that saved him later in life, and the Battle of Monongahela. He had two horses shot out from under him. The coat that he was wearing was pierced four times by bullets. There's the famous sniper incident where a British sniper had a chance to shoot him and it didn't. What other things have happened to him through his life that you think maybe made him realize, wow, God is really looking out for me. He must have something in store for me that he wants me to accomplish.
During the Revolution, there were a series of, we just describe them as amazing acts of providence. I think escaping the Continental Army off of Long Island mm-hmm. Was one of those great miracles, where early in the war, in his campaign to win New York, or at least to win New York City, the British maneuvered the Continental Army onto Long Island, and he was out on the tip of the island. They were right ready to close the trap on the army, and Washington had recruited Gloucester fishermen from Massachusetts who were experts with small boats. By providence, they had this fog that closed in that night, and the Gloucester fishermen were able to row the Continental Army off of the tip of Long Island back to the mainland where they could escape. I mean, time and time again, the British almost had them, but through some mysterious act of providence, in this case, this fog that blew in, they were able to save themselves. Same thing similarly happened almost at Valley Forge. And so we see throughout the Revolution, just extraordinarily lucky, but also one can look at it as acts of providence that saved the colonials at just the right time.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, let's go ahead and take a break there. Come back, we'll talk about more of that providence with George Washington. It's our annual 4th of July show. We're talking with Greg Leo. Stay with us. And welcome back. It's our annual 4th of July show. We're talking with Greg Leo. He's our go-to historian for these annual shows. And this year, we're talking about George Washington. And Greg, going out of that last break, you were talking about the providence that Washington continued to see in his life. And you mentioned Valley Forge was another element of providence. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Well, throughout the Revolution, it was a ragtag band of farmers and, you know, people who had strong beliefs, but not a lot of resources. There were foreign officers that, you know, came and helped and really served, really helped to organize the Continentals. But the Continental Army always had the problem of farmers would go home for the harvest, or mm-hmm. they'd kind of come and go. And sometimes Washington had to, you know, enforce discipline or to keep an army in the field. So the whole point of the Revolutionary War was the British were trying to destroy our will to fight, to really destroy the Continental Army. And so at Valley Forge, one of the toughest times during the war, of course, you know, Washington had the Continental Army in Pennsylvania. It was very cold. There was almost no food. The Continental Congress had more or less abandoned them in terms of resources. And the army was really fending for itself. There's a lot of desertions. At that time, Washington, this strength of his personality kept the army in the field. And of course, the audacious move of then rowing across the Delaware River, attacking Trenton, catching the Hessians after a night on the town, basically winning that battle was a real tonic and brought the Continental Army back to life.
Right.
So there's so many times during the Revolution when it was the sheer power of leadership and character on George Washington's part that kept the stream of freedom alive.
You know, it seems like in life, when you have these elements of providence hitting you, and you know, when those kinds of things happen, the accomplishments that end up following that stem from that usually stem from one of two mindsets. You either see yourself as special and you can do great things, or that God sees you as special and wants you to accomplish great things through you. It's two very different mindsets, and one is of arrogance and the other is of humility. And it really explains, I think, why Washington did not keep power when it was given to him. Had he adopted that arrogance mindset, he probably would have retained presidential power and we would have been right back to a monarchy.
Well, that's right. And the humility that he showed throughout his life, there were a lot of things to be humble about, if I can kind of paraphrase Churchill there. I mean, first of all, he was extraordinarily tall for his age. For his time, he was over 6 feet. At that time, many people were, you know, way shorter than 6 feet. He did have bad teeth. He was always very concerned about having just excellent manners and about having this civility. And so he basically wrote a guide for young men about civility called Washington's Rules of Civility. Yeah, I have a copy of it, and it's amazing what this says and what a guide it is. It says, for example, here, it says, in good manners, prefer them to whom we speak before ourselves, especially if they be above us, with whom we have no short not to begin. So there's this tremendous humility in this man where he really respected other people and wanted to make sure that he fit in. And so he was kind of an awkward country guy who fit in, and through working through the Virginia aristocracy, ended up being the richest man in America.
So since we're talking about providence, let's talk a little bit about his spiritual side. Of course, what we have today is a lot of revisionist historians writing about a time period in American history that they don't really like. And they don't, of course, really like America sometimes, it seems. So when it comes to things right. like spirituality, that's another subject that they really don't like, because God is someone that they don't like. So it's hard to trust anything that these modern historians have to say on Washington's spirituality. But many accounts say that essentially Washington didn't really mean it when he cited God's involvement in his own life or that of the nation, that when he used the word God, which he did frequently, he didn't really mean it. It was really for public relations or referencing a non-personal Masonic type of entity, that sort of thing. So from your own research, what do you make of it? Was Washington a believer in God, an actual Christian, or was he just saying this to win public opinion?
No, I think he really did believe. I think he was a believer. I think he understood that there was divine providence involved in so many of these things. And he had high moral standards about treating other people with dignity and respect. There is a problem with slavery. He was a slaveholder and made no apologies about that. But that was, I think a lot of that was a function of the times. But he was enlightened about religion. He understood it. He said one time, being no bigot myself to any mode of worship, he had a passionate dislike of clergy who kind of use Christianity as a way of profiting or organizing. But he actually was a Christian, and I think understood that God was looking at what was going on here, and it was about being judged for how you act. And again, the quality of your character.
Sure. So I actually sat in his pew there in Philadelphia, at the church that he went to. That was pretty cool, you know, because apparently you paid for your pew. Otherwise, you stood in the back. But that's pretty cool that he had the family pew there. So speaking of Philadelphia, Washington was a delegate to the Second Continental Congress, which wrote the Declaration of Independence, but he didn't put his name on it. So where was Washington on the 4th of July?
He had gone to Cambridge and was organizing the troops outside of Boston because he knew that the declaration, as important as it was, would not really determine until the army in the field was able to win. So he was organizing the Continental Army basically to do battle with the British in Boston at that time.
Mm. So did he know that they were busy drafting the Declaration of Independence? Were they already starting to do that when he'd left?
He understood that there was this great dialogue that was going on between Adams and Jefferson. I think he had respect of both of them, but he also knew that he wasn't the intellectual equal of either of those guys. Hmm. His job was to organize the troops. He was a military man, and he thought that this kind of higher form of enlightened statesmanship really belonged to others. Hmm. So again, you know, he was doing what was appropriate at the time, which was to get the army organized to do battle. And of course they did at the Battle of Bunker Hill.
Right.
Because, not too long after.
Yeah. Because otherwise drafting the Declaration of Independence wouldn't really mean anything if you couldn't actually win the war. Do you know if he got a copy of it out in the field? Did he maybe read it to the troops or something?
They did. Yes, they did get a copy. Not on the 4th of July, but sure. Later, you know, sure. Everything, you know, happened with messengers riding long distances. But when he received the copy of the Declaration, he assembled the troops, I believe, on the Commons in Cambridge, and read the Declaration aloud. And that was commonly done basically at every crossroads in America. People read the Declaration, understood that we were at war, and shocking to many, inspiring to some.
Sure. Okay, let's go ahead and take a break there. We'll have more with Greg Leo talking about the 4th of July with George Washington. Stay with us. And welcome back. It's our annual 4th of July show, our 12th annual, if you can believe it. We're talking today with Greg Leo, and we're focusing in on George Washington. And Greg, during the break there, you're mentioning some fascinating books that you've come across here. One is by Ron Chernow, Washington Alive. So tell us a little bit about that book.
Well, Ron Chernow is just a fabulous historian who has done a very deep 800-page dive into who George Washington was. This book actually predates the Hamilton book that's gotten all the acclaim and, you know, the Broadway play and all. But it's a very detailed history about him and his personality, about how Washington, how he was kind of formed in this kind of rough-hewn backcountry life and really difficult relationship with his mom, with his mother, you know, and eventually had to kind of work his way up. But through talent and skill, I mean, he was one of the best horsemen of his time, at a time when it mattered. And he was a fabulous dancer. And in the course of things, because of his character and his ability to work with other people, he was able to move up through the aristocracy in Virginia, eventually marrying Martha Custis, who was, of course, the richest woman in Virginia, making George Washington one of the biggest landowners in America. So by the time he was general, he was also very successful in terms of plantation, running his plantation and all the agricultural things he did.
So talk to us a little bit about his relationships with some of the people that he really stayed friends with really for life. You've got Knox there who served with him during the war. He ended up becoming his Secretary of War. Hamilton, I know, was an aide for Washington. What were some of the other relationships that were really important to him?
Yeah, I'll just start with those two. Knox, of course, was, you know, famous for bringing the cannon over the Ticonderoga.
Yes.
Ticonderoga in the northern New York was a key battle that controlled that area along that Hudson River corridor. And of course, Knox then became the artillery chief for the Continental Army and was very close to Washington. Admired in a way, totally loved Washington, as many of Washington's generals did. Hamilton was almost like a son to Washington. Washington kept Hamilton as an aide-de-camp and recognized his, you know, incredible intelligence and his insight, and frankly protected him from leading the charge. As a young man, Hamilton wanted to be out in front, and Washington pulled him back until the final battle there at Yorktown. There's a famous story about Redoubt number 10 at Yorktown, which was a strong point in the British line. And finally, he knew that if Hamilton hadn't been blooded in battle, that he would never quite feel like he had that experience. And so he finally let Hamilton lead the troops at Redoubt number 10, which, of course, was the critical move when Cornwallis's line caved at Yorktown that brought about the final victory at Yorktown. So he had a wonderful relationship with the generals. and a wonderful and terrible relationship with Benedict Arnold, which we should get at in some detail here.
Sure. Actually, since you bring him up, let's go ahead and talk about that, because, you know, you always hear about the betrayal there, but what was their relationship like on a personal level between those two?
He admired and respected Arnold, and Arnold was quite an accomplished general. And, of course, had led the Continental Army at Saratoga, at the Battle of Saratoga, which was just a very important controlling of the Hudson River Valley. So from a strategic point of view, the British were trying to divide America in half using the Hudson as the way of kind of separating New England from the Mid-Atlantic states. And so at the Battle of Saratoga, Johnny Burgoyne and the British were totally routed by Benedict Arnold and the Continental Army, which really set up Arnold to be one of America's great generals. He was injured in the battle and was kind of put in charge of the garrison at West Point, which is a promontory point there on the Hudson.
Yeah.
The Continentals had put a chain across the river and had artillery to fend off any British attack at West Point, making it impassable. And then, of course, Mayor Andre, who was a famous, colonel in the British Army, turned Benedict Arnold, who was jealous that he had been sidelined. He felt he had been sidelined and wasn't given the respect that he deserved after Saratoga. And Benedict Arnold flipped and went to the British and had a plot to give West Point to the British, which was unsuccessful and later foiled. But a lot of people after that doubted George Washington's judge of character, that he hadn't seen it coming and maybe should have with Benedict Arnold. And so a really great book has recently been published on this by Nathaniel Philbrick, which is called Valiant Ambition, which is the story of George Washington, Benedict Arnold, and the fate of the American Revolution. That is a page turner. And I recommend that as a good winter read for somebody interested in the topic.
Well, on a personal level, how did Washington take that betrayal? Did he see that as just, you know, this was somebody trying to take advantage during a wartime, or did he see that really as a personal attack on him?
He saw it as a personal attack. He was shocked and hurt and almost quit. And there were some in the Congress that wanted him to quit.
Wow.
And it was, again, one of those providential things that he did not quit, that he did persevere. But he questioned himself. He said, how could I have gotten that so wrong? And how could I have not seen that coming? And it was an epic betrayal. And, of course, a famous betrayal that even to this day, when we see a person who's betrayed people, we say he's a Benedict Arnold.
Right.
And Benedict Arnold, of course, went over to the British, went to England, and died an ignoble death. In the end, a complete failure.
Sure.
Washington survived, though, mainly basically because people came to him and said, no, you're the glue that's holding us together. You've got to persevere.
That's really interesting. Let's go and take a break there. Coming back, we're going to be talking about some of his victories and his defeats and overcoming the odds. We're talking about George Washington today on our annual 4th of July show, doing that with Greg Leo. Stay with us. And welcome back. It's our annual 4th of July show. We're talking with Greg Leo, and we're focusing in on George Washington this year. It's been a fascinating discussion about his life. And, of course, what he is most known for is being the general of the armies there during the Revolution. So let's talk about some of these victories. And, you know, in putting this show together, I've tried to picture myself in his shoes. You know, here Britain has the world's biggest army at the time and best equipped. They've got access to all sorts of funding, which, of course, the Continental Congress never really had, just scads of money to arm and equip the army. In fact, even just feed them sometimes was a struggle. So talk to us about what Washington was truly facing when they declare war on Britain and hand him the reins to the army and say, here you go, go win it.
You know, it's amazing that he kept the army together and in the field and as a fighting force. As soon as the army was gone, then the vision of freedom would be gone too. So the main thing Washington did was keep it alive. He really didn't have really a big military victory in the sense of a Napoleon or a, you know, Caesar might have had, but rather it was a series of small victories that just, you know, kept them alive, kept enough energy to get people to attract into the cause. What really changed was a combined effort of what Jefferson and Franklin had been doing to bring the French into the war. So, you know, this really was a continuation of the French and Indian War, where, you know, France and England were at war. And so the French fleet under Admiral de Grasse came to the Virginia Capes, beat the British fleet, who was Admiral by Admiral Hood, who Mount Hood is named after, the first, who became later the first Lord of the Admiralty. Admiral Hood got beaten by the French fleet, which was unheard of. Normally, the British fleet would be the stronger, but in this, at the Battle of the Virginia Capes, beat them. And Washington had maneuvered Cornwallis onto the York Peninsula and was basically had him bottled up at Yorktown. That was an amazing strategic act. And what happened was Cornwallis was overconfident and got beyond, beyond his lines of communication, his lines of supply, and then got cut off and expected the fleet to come pick him up. And when he dialed for his ride out of there, the fleet couldn't deliver. And so Washington caught him. You know, the drummer played, the world turned upside down. They struck their flag, and our country was born.
Hmm. So in the early years, it wasn't so easy. He faced kind of a string of defeats. And again, he's fighting the world's biggest army at the time. So what was it in those early years, you think, that kept him going despite all the odds against him?
Well, I think he had this sense of this perseverance that you don't give up, that nobody likes a quitter. He had this magnetic force of personality because he was, you know, such a human being that people trusted. He had this sense of character that he could get people to follow him, this charismatic leadership. He never gave up because I think he knew he was right and there was too much on the line. He would have lost everything had the British won, as all of the revolutionary leaders would have been executed, their lands taken away, extraordinarily harshly treated. So, you know, defeat was not an option. And he persevered through so many difficulties, and that gave our country the opportunity to exist. And so George Washington, I think, is the greatest, you know, leader in American history. Historians oftentimes will put Washington, Lincoln, and FDR kind of in the top three, but they don't really follow the Washington story as they should. Without Washington, we would not be the United States. He was the essential guy at the essential time, which allowed us to enjoy the freedom that we have today.
One of the other things that he's really known for is getting the army through the winter at Valley Forge. And we know it was a harsh winter, made even worse by bad shelter and poor supplies. I've actually been to Valley Forge and got to go into some of those shelters that the soldiers were living in. And they were not, and I can't imagine spending the depth of winter in some of those. I actually had a direct relative that lived through Valley Forge with Washington. He developed an infection that settled in his hip, and it caused him pain the rest of his life, but he managed to go through about six major battles even so. You know, but this army went in weak at a bad point in the war. Things were not necessarily looking great, but they emerged a stronger, better army. What do you attribute that to?
Well, this first of all, they survived, and then crossing the Delaware and beating the British at Trenton was an elixir. I mean, that basically gave everybody hope, because most folks in America thought that it was over, that the Continental Army had been run to ground. It was now, you know, off in this kind of wilderness in Pennsylvania, and, you know, had no shoes, had no food, had smallpox, you know, just a lot of folks didn't expect the army to emerge from Valley Forge, but it did, because there was a leader with hope, and they were able to, you know, turn a small battle into what was perceived as an important win. And once the Hessians had been beaten at Trenton, then people were saying, well, look, they sent this mercenary army of the, you know, the strongest army in the world, sent their trained killers to kill him, and they got beat instead. Mm. So that sent a signal that hope was alive. And that spring, they had new recruits. They had a renewed energy in the war. So it's the perseverance through the tough times that character is built on that really is Washington's story of success.
Sure, absolutely. You know, and as a leader, part of his leadership style, he also found other good leaders. And of course, they had the trainers that came in who actually was, I think, a former Hessian. And he was able to retrain the troops to make them into a modern day fighting force, as you said, that these were a ragtag team of farmers and whatnot. And he had instead developed them into a fighting force, which
Von Steuben.
Yes.
And Von Steuben and Lafayette mm-hmm. and other folks who just... they just understood the British to be tyrants, and they joined the cause. So it was kind of this ragtag group of farmers and merchants and then foreign officers who taught them military discipline and procedure. And they actually were an effective fighting force towards the end of the war, which was how they were able to maneuver, you know, Cornwallis mm-hmm. down to the York Peninsula.
Right. Well, that's what I like about Washington is it wasn't always about him. He was happy to spread that power. He didn't seek that glory. He looked for the best solutions for his men. And I think that's one of the reasons why they truly respected him. Okay, let's go ahead and take a break there. We'll have more with Greg Leo talking about George Washington on our annual 4th of July show. And welcome back. It's our annual 4th of July show, our 12th annual, and we're talking with Greg Leo, focusing on George Washington this year. And Greg, we've been talking about Valley Forge there and how they managed to come out of that. And we've also talked about some of the providence that was always very apparent in Washington's life. And there's a famous incident where a British sniper had climbed a tree and had a clear shot at an unidentified American commander who it turned out was Washington. But the sniper didn't know that at the time, but he just was so impressed with how regal his bearing was that he just felt he couldn't take the shot. You know, you hear things like that, and again, you just you can't help but see the hand of God in Washington's life. Can you tell us a little bit more about that incident?
I don't know much more than what you've said, but I do know several times on the battlefield, and particularly in this case with the sniper, it was the way he carried himself. He did lead from the front. So he was not, you know, in the rear of the troops. He was basically helping lead the troops in the front, which is a very dangerous thing when you're on horseback. And in this particular case, it was the regal bearing. And the sniper said, maybe this is one we shouldn't take. And I think that happened actually more than once. There were plots against Washington's life. There were saboteurs and assassins that were sent to kill him. But he was able... through, again, I think providence, good luck, and having very loyal people around him, able to protect himself. Had Washington died, there's a very good chance we would not be the United States today.
Well, that was actually going to be my question, is that what would have happened if they had taken that shot? I mean, who would have taken over had Washington perished?
It's a great open question. There's Nathaniel Greene. There was you know, other generals who had done well. But nobody that had the gravitas, the leadership, the charisma of Washington. So somebody would have had to step up, but they were more regional type leaders rather than one that was seen as a national leader. I mean, Washington had organized troops in Boston, had the campaign in New York, was fighting in Virginia, eventually even down into the Carolinas towards the end of the war. And so he was a guy that was well known by local troops. Remember, at the time, local militias were organized by kind of like local politicians who would then get the local farm folk to come together. And so they were a collection of militias that Washington formed into actually a Continental Army that answered to a national type leader. So this was an important part of the nation building that actually had an influence later, as we, you know, after the Constitution was set up, we this is the formation of the strong central government. And of course, Washington later on as president, working with Hamilton, was for a stronger central government, which really personified that Adams vision rather than the Jefferson type populism that would later, evolve into the, check and balance that we have in American politics since then.
Sure. You had mentioned that there was a number of saboteurs that were sent against him. Can you talk to us a little bit more about that?
Well, there was a spy war that was really intense going on between the British and the Americans. You know, Washington himself was quite a spy master. He had the Culper ring, which was a ring of six secret agents that were infiltrated into the British in New York and in other places, where they're able to understand troop movements and kind of what the intentions of the British were ahead of time. Very famous. Many people may have seen this in Washington Spies, which has been a popular TV show, right, largely based on fact. And so the British on the same time had Tories. Remember, about a quarter of the American population were still loyal to the crown. And a lot of landed folks were spying on the Continentals and feeding information to the British Army. And so there was quite a bit of spying going back and forth. A lot of this was like Capture the Flag, where if you can identify the leader of the army, in this case Washington, kill him and decapitate that force, then you're able then to persevere and master that force on the field. And so there were attempts to kill Washington, and people couldn't get close enough because he was loyally guarded by a group of really strong soldiers that eventually became the Society of Cincinnati, who were the loyal top officer corps of the Continental Army.
I didn't know about that. As far as the spy ring, I've only seen a few of those shows, and it's always been very fascinating. Do you think we know the full extent of that spy ring that he had put out? And also, can you give us a little bit more insight into how they operated?
Several good books are written on this, and it was quite extensive. And even by today's standards, pretty sophisticated. They used ciphers to write the messages that were written, in invisible ink. They had cutouts. They used things that we would know today as good spycraft, in order to protect information. Many of the Culpers, Culper 6 secret agents, were never found and withheld their identity even after the revolution. But it was essentially, barkeepers and others that would infiltrate into the British officers, where they would drink and talk about what they were doing. People would overhear that information and then feed it back through to Washington. So Washington was quite the spy master. And had he not had the intelligence of what the British intentions were and what troop movements were planned, that kind of thing, then I think he would not have been able to move his own troops in a fashion that kept them from getting beaten on the battlefield or captured.
What's really cool about that is that these were everyday people. They weren't, the well-to-do. They weren't military. They weren't today's specially trained foreign operatives, that sort of thing. And yet these everyday people are really what helped him win the war.
But there were people that loved their freedom, and they saw the alternative was, the harsh governing of a British crown. There was horrible spy prison ships that were anchored out in the harbors. Mm-hmm. People were thrown in these just horrible dungeon-like situations. There was torture of American patriots that went on. Of course, we saw Nathan Hale, who was a intelligence officer, hung. So there, this was a nasty war of going on between spies. Eventually, we hung Mayor Andre, who was the one who turned Benedict Arnold. And Andre was a very interesting guy, an artist, a poet, and a spy master himself. And so he's actually in turn. You can see that character there. But he was a real person who was Swiss educated, very intelligent, charming, and ruthless, and executed a number of patriots who were carrying information for Washington. So quite the spy war is one of the more interesting stories of the Revolution.
Right.
And it actually kind of sets the tone for the intelligence services today.
Yeah, absolutely. And what's really cool about that, too, is that you mentioned those prison ships out there. And these ordinary people, these patriots, they knew the risks. They saw the ships out there moored in the harbor where they knew people were being tortured and killed. But they found the courage to do it anyway. And I think that's just awesome.
Yeah. Lovers of freedom.
Yeah,
it's absolutely about freedom, this whole thing. And it's a great story. I hope you'll read one of the three books I mentioned, the Valiant Ambition or the Washington book by Turnow, or any one of the other great books about the Revolutionary War. Yeah. It reads like an adventure novel, and I hope you enjoy.
Yeah. Okay, so let's go ahead and take a break there. Coming back, we'll talk about post-revolution and the presidency. Stay with us. Our annual 4th of July show continues with Greg Lehman. And welcome back in our final segment now here on the iSpire Radio Show. It's our annual 4th of July show. We're talking with Greg Leo, and we've been focusing on George Washington. And Greg, we want to make sure that we plug an event that you have every year. You celebrate the 4th at the Newell House. Talk to our audience a little bit about that.
Why, thank you. It's a free event. Everyone is invited. Historic Newell Pioneer Village at the Shampooey State Heritage Area, 2 o'clock on the 4th of July. Bring a lawn chair. We're going to sit under the cool of the trees, and a couple of three or four things are going to happen. We're going to read the Declaration of Independence. Everybody gets a line to read, which is always great fun. We've got some great old-fashioned fiddling from Truman Price, who is just an amazing, good fiddler. And then we're going to do a bit of a skit about Oregon in 1865 from one of Abraham Lincoln's neighbors is going to come and join us and tell us about Abraham Lincoln, followed by the famous French Prairie Pie Contest, where we're going to have a pie judging contest and then auction off the best, most delicious pies of French Prairie.
Well, that sounds
good. Newell House, historic Newell House, 2 o'clock on the 4th of July.
Well, that sounds like a great way to spend the 4th. So I want to talk to you in the time that we have remaining a little bit about after the war. Of course, we had the first attempt at a federal government, the Articles of Confederation, which did not go so well because it gave too much power to the states and almost none to the federal government, which meant the states were left ununified. So we tried again and ended up with the Constitution. And George Washington was elected in 1789. At that time, there was no political parties as we think of them today, just really Federalists and Anti-Federalists, and yet both so-called parties, they both supported Washington for president, the only president ever unanimously elected in the Electoral College. So why did both sides, everybody, support him?
Well, he had been the man who really led the army that created the country. And so and he had been ecumenical, working with both sides. There were ideological differences right from the beginning, but he was able to span those differences, hold everything together, and then went on the field. Remember, at those first days, we were still exporting the Tories, sending a quarter of the country that was, supportive of the British to Canada and back to England. And so getting rid of those landowners that did not support the revolution. So it took some time for the country to kind of, get solidified. And then, of course, we had the Constitution and the election of Washington as president. But, he was offered to be king before that. At the beginning, they said, well, why don't you just be our king? And he said, no, I don't want not what this war was about. This war was about, self-government and electing people, not anointing a new king. And so twice he denied doing that. He did not want to do that. He said, I'll serve if asked, but don't ask me to be a king, because all I want to do is, the executive function and the new constitution.
Well, and that was such a key thing that he did, to give up power after only 2 terms of presidency. As far as I know, that was the first time ever in world history that a man with the power that Washington had willingly stepped down before his own death and gave up that power. Do you think that people expected that he would actually give up that power? What was the reaction to it here and abroad when he actually did, in fact, step down?
They loved him. And they love him in a way that went on for generations, for 100 years, 150, 200 years now. Washington was about us, the people. not about him, the leader, him, the person, all of us together having self-government, which he personified the ideal of what American freedom was about, which was everyone having equal say, you and I'm working together. He didn't want to be king. He didn't want to be the guy in charge. Is so unusual in American history, but it goes just right to who the guy was. I mean, that was his character. It was not him. And I think that that's why he's the greatest president and brought us out of this kind of churning cauldron of revolution into more stability. The emergence of the political party system is a rational way to deal with the conflicts, these natural ideological conflicts. And even to this day, we're still, you know, debating it, having elections, having peaceful outcomes, not having coup d'etats. So that he set the tone for how America can work out its differences within the context of the Constitution.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, his presidency is sometimes, I think, romanticized in a way anyway, but it wasn't easy starting a new country, which is exactly what they did. He presided over the first cabinet, which
he
itself
had the whiskey rebellion for one thing.
Yes,
people they didn't want to pay taxes, and so they revolted, and they said, "No, you're not gonna. You're just like King George. You're gonna tax our whiskey? No way." Right. So he had to send the troops and quash the whiskey rebellion. I mean, it was no bed of roses.
No, absolutely not. And of course, he had the first cabinet, which certainly disagreed on a lot of things, especially over foreign policy. Some of them wanted to support France and its war against Britain, and meanwhile, you got others that said, oh, we should support Britain, the country they just broken away from, which seems pretty contradictory. Greg, unfortunately, we are up against the clock here. I want to thank you so much for your time today. This has been a fascinating look at Washington's life.
Thank you. What a great opportunity. Hope to see you at Newell House. Everybody celebrate their freedom. Happy Independence Day.
If you want to go to Greg's annual 4th of July event, it is held at the Newell House. That's N-E-W-E-L-L, Newell House in Champuy Park. I've been to it. It's a really great time. And you're surrounded by patriots who all love this country. Champuy Park is easily reached from I-5 and is northeast of St. Paul. Make a day of it. St. Paul has a rodeo and fireworks on the 4th. They are spectacular. Check this week's show page on iSpyRadio.com. A happy 4th of July to all of you out there, and thank you for joining us today as we look back on George Washington. As you can imagine, we have a huge amount of research and further information for you on this week's show page. One particularly great resource for all things Washington is MountVernon.org. In addition to the state that Washington loved so dearly, they have some great details on George himself and significant time periods of his life, including about his time in the French and Indian War, which really did shape him for the man he needed to be to lead this nation in its formative years. There are other great resources up there, too. The WashingtonPapers.org is working to publish digital editions of the Washington family's correspondence. One item they have for Revolutionary War junkies is his itinerary, which details where he was every day throughout the entire war. You can find links to those, as well as to timelines, sites that discuss his accomplishments, notes on his battles, his defeats, and his victories. You know, defeats teach us humility and perseverance. Victories ought to also teach humility and perseverance, that we win when we persevere, and that it is not by ourselves alone that we succeed. Washington truly understood that, and I hope all of us patriots adopt that same belief and outlook. Because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.